This is Knox Manning bringing you front page features, the background and color of the day's events, stories from the heart of the news, brought to you every weekday at this time and Saturdays at 4:45. Today's feature page is sponsored by the growers of Washington State apples, recognized as the world's finest eating apples, grown in the apple bowl of the world. Now today's feature page, which presents the small man in a shabby room, the dog who built a hospital, the Cinderella story of 1947, and a thought for day's end. The attention of an entire world today is focused on a shabby room tucked away in a remote corner of the finance ministry in Paris. It's a strange room to be the cynosure of millions of minds. It's tiny and its furnishings are drab. There's a battered army cot covered with a gray blanket. There's a bureau, a table, one chair, and a washstand. The rest of the room is piled high with books. In this room lives a small, aging, bald-headed man whose reddish mustache is shot with gray. He's not handsome. In fact, he's ugly. He's bashful and retiring. And in the late silent hours of night, he must be sitting with his head dejectedly resting in his hands. It's this plain little man in this tiny, shabby room upon whom the fate of France may well depend in one of its most crucial hours. Because the man is Robert Schumann, the new premier of France. Schumann's presence in this tiny room is, in a way, symbolic of the multiplying troubles facing his nation. The new premier is a wealthy man. But in France, as well as in most of Europe, even money can't always overcome the frightful shortage of housing. At the moment, when France needs the most desperate recovery efforts in its history, the nation is immersed in turmoil instead of toil, is privately oiling its guns rather than its machines. It's small wonder that small, unprepossessing Robert Schumann, after a long and troubled day at his official desk, may be sitting in his small room, his head in his hands. Schumann will try hard. His record shows that. His name is German. That's because he comes from Lorraine, of a family that remained loyal to France after Bismarck wrested the iron-rich province from the beaten government of Napoleon III in 1870. All his life, Schumann had been an underground fighter against the Germans. Even as a youth, he was working constantly for the return of Lorraine to France and was an underground intriguer against the Kaiser. At the conclusion of World War I, Schumann saw his dream realized. Lorraine was returned to France, and its grateful people sent Schumann to Parliament in Paris. In private life, he practiced law and added to the already large fortune left him by his family. The death of his wife caused him to plunge into politics, also to adopt his only known hobby, the collection of rare and expensive books. When the Germans began to break through in 1940, Premier Paul Reynaud, who admired Schumann's knowledge of finance, asked him to join the cabinet. Schumann was given the impossible task of caring for the streams of refugees pouring into France from Belgium and Holland. And later, when all of France was in panic-stricken flight, his was a job beyond any human effort. But Schumann himself stuck by that job until the end and refused to flee. This took courage of a high order. Having been a Lorraine patriot before World War I, Schumann technically could have been shot for a traitor. But the Germans never got around to trying him. Eventually, he escaped. And despite his advanced age, he joined the underground and served as a guerrilla soldier until France was free. Then Schumann joined the party formed by de Gaulle and Bidault. When those two broke, Schumann stayed with Bidault. Later, although strongly opposed to Marxism, he remained as finance minister in the socialist cabinet of Ramage. The austere little man, much of whose life has been spent in seemingly hopeless causes, now must attempt to steer his nation down the middle of the road, when no middle-of-the-road party seems to remain, only the left and the right. That he can succeed, there must be considerable doubt on today's feature page. Well, I can't think of a better time than just before Thanksgiving to give you some good news about food prices. So right now, let me sing out the good word about Washington State apples. You've seen these wonderful Washington apples at your grocer's, the big, bright, delicious, and the round, ruddy Jonathan's. You know there are no finer apples anywhere than the apples of Washington State. Yet these hand-picked Washington apples are reasonable in price. You can actually get them for less than they cost last year. And there's never been a better harvest of Washington apples than this year's crop. Beneath tender skin, their clean white meat is firm and full of flavor, rich in tangy juice. Fresh from harvest supplies, Washington apples come to market every day in fast refrigerated cars, and they come to you at a budget-sized price. So take home lots of them. Heap them high in a bowl and put them in your icebox. Then serve them when they're well chilled, crisp and crackling, for the best apple eating in the world. Next, The Dog Who Built a Hospital. The day that Tempo died was one of the saddest in the history of swing music. When the word got around, there was moisture in the eyes of jive musicians from coast to coast, from the Three Deuces on New York's 52nd Street to Billy Berg's on Hollywood's Vine. All agreed with sad shakes of the head that somehow the game just wouldn't seem the same without Tempo. He was around two of the nation's most famous bands for 11 years. Every music man knew him, and thousands of swing fans, too. In fact, Tempo was downright famous. And as all agreed the day he died, if a dog's life was what he had, then it was a good one. Tempo first was introduced to the world of music 11 years ago, a squirming, friendly little black pup. He was introduced by Lionel Hampton, who at the time was playing the vibra harp with Benny Goodman's quintet, along with Gene Krupa, Teddy Wilson, and Harry James. And Tempo, Hampton tells you, and according to United Press correspondent Aline Mosby, he'll tell you for hours, Tempo brought them all good luck. The minute Tempo arrived, fortune seemed to come with him. It's no wonder that Goodman's band became downright superstitious about the pooch. They loved him, too, because he was a music lover. Or as Hampton tells it reverently, yes, Tempo sure was. We'd jam in the dressing room after shows. Tempo would sit there quiet as anything. Most dogs howl at music, but Tempo just sort of opened his mouth just like he was smiling. Probably no dog ever was more pampered than this small black Scotty. Mrs. Hampton was the only wife allowed to travel with Goodman's band. That's so she could mind the dog. And no matter if the band's travel was by train, plane, or ship, Tempo always was smuggled aboard. Along about 1940, Hampton quit Goodman and formed his own band. Every performance he played, Tempo was there. Hampton's luck kept going up and up. So maybe it's no wonder Tempo had a special bed and expensive sweaters and the top cuts of dog biscuits. He even got mail from Hampton fans. This fame reached such proportions that when Tempo reached his 10th anniversary, Hampton threw a birthday party for him in San Francisco. Every musician and disc jockey in town was on hand to pay his respects and bring a gift. It was for that event that Hampton composed one of his most successful songs. It's titled Tempo's Birthday. A couple of months ago, Hampton came to Hollywood to play in a picture. Tempo was sent to the Hampton home in New York. One day, a broken-hearted housekeeper phoned that Tempo had died of a heart attack as he was being rushed by ambulance to a hospital. As Hampton says sadly, he traveled around and heard so much jive, I guess the excitement just got his heart. Well, the funeral of this little black Scotty was quite an event. Every big name in the music business sent flowers, and he was buried in the famous Pet Cemetery near Yonkers, New York. Well, as we said, there were sniffles from coast to coast the day Tempo died. But that isn't the end. Hampton has decided the music world shouldn't forget Tempo, so he's building the dog a monument. It'll be a clinic in a Hollywood pet hospital. It'll be for folks who can't afford high-priced animal doctors. In this clinic, pets will be cared for free. The clinic will be supported by the money Hampton makes from records of the tune he wrote in the dog's honor, Tempo's birthday. His band and a few others will toss benefits for Tempo's clinic once a year. There'll be a plaque on the wall, too. It'll read, In Memory of Tempo, the Swing World's Mascot. He led a dog's life, and it was a good one. It's a sentiment we think most fitting on today's feature page. Now, the Cinderella story of 1947. The most popular fairy story ever written is that of Cinderella. Maybe this classic story of rags to riches, of obscurity to fame overnight, has retained its centuries of popularity because, unlike most fairy stories, it occasionally comes true. Not often, of course, but often enough to keep dreams alive in the breasts of millions of girls who hope that someday they'll be the one to meet the Prince Charming, to suddenly acquire the gilded coach. You've seen the story told a thousand times, of course. It's the entertainment world's oldest and most surefire plot. Obscure young actress, preferably an understudy, steps into star's role, is a smash success, and overnight wins fame, fortune, her name in lights, and, of course, the boy. And to repeat, in show business, this plot occasionally comes to life. There was the time when an unknown young actress appeared in a play called Dear Brutus, and overnight electrified Broadway. Her name was Helen Hayes. Another unknown once became nationally famous after her first appearance in a play called Rainbow. That girl's name was Ruth Chatterton. Yes, it happens occasionally. And the other night, it happened again. Broadway's jaded critics and the usual first-night audience were on hand to attend the opening of a comedy titled For Love or Money. Advance notices had told them it was a comedy, and the author's name, F. Hugh Herbert, was a guarantee that the play would be cleverly fashioned, but nothing especially significant. The usual patter of rather bored applause sounded as the curtain went up. Then, as one person, the spectators were jerked to the edge of their seats. Onto the stage rushed a hysterical girl, barefooted, dripping wet in blue jeans and an old shirt. From that opening entrance down to the closing scene, the audience couldn't take its eyes off that girl. Ordinarily, it would have been a difficult but not too spectacular part, but this girl invested it with that magic spark, that personality that came right out over the footlights, that combination of stardust and of fire that marks a truly great and inspired performance. Excitement in the theater mounted. The final curtain and the audience went wild. Usually cynical critics rushed to their typewriters to pour out glowing accolades at white heat. The next day, that girl in her first Broadway role was the talk of theatrical circles from coast to coast. Her name went up in lights. National magazines rushed photographers to take pictures, reporters to get stories. She was famous. Her name, June Lockhart. Yes, hers is the story of Cinderella come to life once again. Of course, there are a few differences. June Lockhart wasn't discovered in a grimy chimney corner. Her life has been spent in a very luxurious Beverly Hills home. She's attended the best school. She wasn't born in a theater trunk, or if she was, it would have been satin-lined. Because her father, that grand guy, Gene Lockhart, and her actress mother, Kathleen Lockhart, always have been very successful and highly paid performers. But quite naturally, June Lockhart has wanted to be an actress ever since she can remember. When she graduated from the Sanglis exclusive Westlake School for Girls, she still returned to help them out with the school plays. One year, the successful playwright Hugh Herbert was persuaded by his daughters to write and direct that play. June Lockhart took part, and he told her, "I'm writing a play, and I'll see that you're starred in it." But a year went by, and she forgot that promise. Meanwhile, she'd met with a few discouragements, had appeared in a few rather minor roles in pictures, but without causing any great furor. Then one day, playwright Herbert called her and said, "Well, the play is ready. When can I see you?" So June Lockhart, practically an unknown, left Hollywood and went to New York. One performance, and she was internationally famous. She's the most discussed young actress of several years. Now she'll be returning to her hometown of Hollywood, but no longer as an obscure bit actress. She'll be sought after, feted, toasted, and honored. She'll be a great star in her own right. And that the top Cinderella story of 1947 couldn't happen to a nicer girl, that her wonderful triumph couldn't be shared by grander parents, is the certain knowledge of today's feature page. For young and old, part and parcel of the feasting around Thanksgiving time is apples, rosy red and shining, crisp and cool, firm and fat with juice. That's the kind of feasting you find in Washington State apples, and there's no better time to enjoy them than now. For in November, harvest supplies of these matchless Washington apples are abundant. Big, sweet, delicious, and plump, spicy Jonathans come from the orchards to market every day in refrigerated cars, fresh and fragrant as though you'd just picked them off the trees. Yes, fruit like that is truly festive. Just naturally belongs on your Thanksgiving table for gay decoration, for wonderful munching, and for health. By the way, a grand party apple is the extra big Washington Delicious, the rich red king-size apple Washington's famous for. You'll want to include some of these in your Thanksgiving apple bowl. Now, Washington apples are pretty fancy eating, that's true, but they don't cost a fancy price. Fact is, they're reasonable in price, actually cost less than they did last year. So, enjoy a good plenty of these fine Washington apples. And remember, they taste best when they're frosty, cool, right from the icebox. Now, this is Knox Manning, turning today's feature page with a thought for day's end. The hardest thing to accomplish is to keep an open hand when charity is asked and a closed mouth when credit is given. Well, these have been the stories behind the news. For an analysis of that news, stay tuned to Charles Collingwood over most of these stations at 5:30, followed by Bob Gerrard's complete report at 5:45. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.